I'm in the German pavilion now with Katharina Sieverding. Katharina, you have a number of large multi-panel works in two sides or on two sides of the pavilion here. But I'm interested to begin with to find out about your particular interest in exploring surface and image in these works, because the ones that we're facing are two images, enlarged images, coming from, I believe, an anatomical source from the skull. Perhaps you could talk about the level at which this image interests you and what you're actually exploring.
Indeed, I started this series of nine works with the skulls, and it is an extension of former works of self-portraits or the search of identity of an individual point of view. And so with these skulls, I point out to the statue of death, whether we leave the whole process of identity with death. Further on, this skull, and the other is a radiological image of a head. So there is another statement. It's a blood test process, which goes with special paper. It's called chromatography. And so it's a very holistic statement. So between these two polarities of identification in the end of the life, which means a skull and death, or which will exist over the death of a person.
Is this a preoccupation of yours at present, this idea of exploring issues and images to do with mortality and aging and the process of decay and change?
I think this is a general question. I always moved in my work in the past three decades. I tried to combine these statements with some political events that happened here in Europe. And so it is the main question. So which kind of responsibility leads to the situation of death, and it's a whole concentration of outside, inside, and the position of a human being at the end of the century, how he deals with his whole national and international identity, how he thinks about how people move over the globe.
Right. You've chosen to use photographic processes in representing these images, and they're photographic processes that have another filter between us and the image. That is, I think some of them look as though they're taken from a printed version of the photograph, in that they have a kind of a pattern that's to do with reproduction. In the one on the left here, it becomes almost abstract, although one can just about make out figuration.
Yes. So this one we'll just stay here. It's the last image in this whole series of nine works. This is a detail of a sequence of the human genome research. Also, the end of this BSE, this animals that died from this virus. So the question in this image, how we cross borders, the question where about the experiments, and the question of where is the border of human life and human manipulation and identity, and also the border of animal life and nature, because this whole catastrophe, this happened because they fed animals with animals. And so the question is, when human beings will be produced through gene manipulation, what kind of identity, so what will this mean?
So now, walking to the end of the gallery, this side of the gallery anyway, we have images of individuals. It looks like almost an image of refugees. Again, the printing process seems to be quite evident on the surface.
These are orphans from Sarajevo, who were taken to Germany 5 years ago and who stayed in Germany, and now they were brought back to Sarajevo. So what happens to these children, and what does it mean with all these military conflicts that are all over the world? and mothers, women are murdered. So what will happen to these children? And for me, it has a resemblance. It takes to this other image that I had in mind, this one person, Korczak, who brought out the Jewish children out of the concentration camp in Theresienstadt. Yeah, it's a metaphor also. So what happens to all these children who are victims of this conflict all over the world?
Finally, can you just add anything about the circumstances of showing this work in Venice, in the Venice Biennale? Are there any particular issues and concerns that you've had to address in making this exhibition here?
I think this kind of context, the Venice Biennale, is something very special. Every nation has a little pavilion. I tried to speak about the situation of human beings in general at the end of this decade or this century. I demonstrate a lot about international problems. It's a special chance to clarify the own work with the public, with the media, more than any other show in the world.
Heidi Grunman, you have been to a number of biennales. Perhaps it would be interesting for you to start talking about the Austrian Pavilion, as you come from Austria.
I personally think that it is one of the most successful contributions to a biennale in general. What one sees in the pavilion is a huge amount of books. And what the announced intention of the Austrian Pavilion in Austria was to propel the so-called Wiener Gruppe, the Viennese group, into the history of modern art, modern culture, as they have not been recognized enough. So it's a very laudable undertaking. The whole contribution of Austria has become an extremely successful piece by the commissioner, Peter Weibel, who is an artist himself. And he has really succeeded in a way to appropriate the Wiener Gruppe. And he feels very strong bonds to this kind of art at any rate. He has, in a way, taken their strategies to develop this piece now in 1997, yeah? And has done a very successful piece, basically by himself, making every visitor to the pavilion a bearer of this history and at the same time somebody who is giving shape to the piece by Peter Weibel by carrying this big book away, which is offered for free. So he's appealing to the greed of our times by offering a beautiful fat catalogue for nothing.
The work is the slab of books, which is very monumental, very powerful. It's like a huge minimalist sculpture, but it gradually will disappear over the period of the Biennale, because, as you say, people will take away this book, which in Venetian heat is quite a big job, really, to carry this heavy object away.
The basically invisible project became, during the opening of the Biennale at any rate, one of the most visible pieces, because wherever you went, you saw one of these big books.
It seems to be that the Biennale is all about visibility. It's interesting how a number of pavilions are increasingly thinking of strategies to externalize their product, their output. I've just been to the Slovenian show off St. Mark's Square installation, where you can take a water bottle with a strap. The British Pavilion has this bag. The French Pavilion have very noticeable bags. So in a sense, it's like kind of a designer biennale.
Yeah, it's appropriating that strategy of merchandising in a way. Everywhere, everything has some articles attached to it. It's whether it's an airline, a radio station, Coca-Cola, or whatever, you can have a hat to put on your head and things like that with a brand name.
What do you think of this Biennale then, the 97 one? What are the high points and the low points?
I had a very, very strong feeling of déjà vu, but I think that's probably the normal reaction if you have been somewhere so many times. But also I think it is, of course, a characteristic of the art scene, because it has become so multiple and so differentiated and is relating to so many traditions that basically the whole history of the contemporary art is present at every biennale. The title here is Future, Present and Past, and somehow I think that the past and the future have shrunk into a very strange kind of presence, a present that is presence in an event.
In the past, when you've been here, there's been an aperto section, but there isn't this year, and there wasn't the last time. Do you think something's missing because of that in terms of a younger group of artists?
Well, I have myself been one of the curators of the aperto in 86. Thinking back, I must say that already in 86, the aperto was in a terrible crisis. The curators had terrible fights and so on and so on, and it was not a very successful manifestation because too many interests were mingled in the show. I think the aperto was really only successful in the beginning with Seemann, and I think Oliva it was, and that statement to make an aperto into a very traditional thing like the Biennale is, that was an important thing to do. Each time when I see that wonderful space in the Corderia, I think it should be the site of site-specific works, you know, done and commissioned for that wonderful space.
Heidi, you're intimately involved in new media, both through your radio station but also through internet and so on. And I just wondered, from that involvement, whether the model that we have here is something that's ossified, that doesn't seem to maybe address what is possible now creatively in terms of new technologies.
There are some exhibitions or events addressing this new media. There is a kind of exhibition with works from the field of new media, a curated exhibition. There is a kind of space that has connections to the internet and so on. So there is something going on at the edges, and the Biennale itself, as the Documenta, has a web space, of course. They are on the internet as an event, as an organization and so on. Though it seems that the Biennale does not have a curated space where there are specific web pieces by net art by artists. But at any rate, I think whatever is done now in that field, in the context of these big events, is very difficult to do, because it's different paradigms and it's such different spaces one is dealing with. And I was also again thinking back to 86 in the Corderia, where I think almost forgotten, a very exemplary thing took place, and that was the Laboratorio Ubiqua, initiated by Roy Escott. And there was in the Corderia a big space with screens all around, where you had slow scan television from all over the world, and there were computers in a circle almost, and there were people for 2 weeks or 3 weeks communicating all the time with the whole world, basically doing exactly what is happening now all the time on the internet. There was no internet at the time. They used all kind of other networks, but they used electronic networks, and they tried to visualize the activity, and they were successful, because I still have the image, for instance, in my head as an image with these screens around. It was in that old building, and so it was a successful installation, I think. And it was very successful in that way, that they succeeded not only to have during these 3 weeks very interesting online projects with the whole world going, but they even went on afterwards and had an online symposium during the whole length of the Biennale. And I think never have there been so many artists participating in the Biennale as in this year, because there was the worldwide online uncurated participation of people who joined the networks, joined the symposium, joined the project, and no curator could control anymore who and which artist was participating.
Were there any pavilions or any artists actually dealing with and addressing those issues of new media?
Yeah, I thought that the French pavilion was quite an interesting example. They took the television as it is today and made it into an object of exhibition by dividing it up into its different components of production. The viewing of what was done as a television program, but was missing was the broadcasting itself. It was basically video, but it referred to television, and they showed in the center of the pavilion what they had produced every day, and then they showed the space and the machines where the producer is sitting, yeah, and editing. Then they showed a space where the actors are making themselves up and where all the props are, and a space where the guests are being interviewed. And they were showing also machines on which people were working for the internet, because today the mass media are connected with the internet and with the computer, and it's that famous convergence of the three, the mass media, telecommunications and the computer, that are changing our media landscape so much. And I thought it was quite nice that they had kind of a grill through which one was looking at each of these production spaces, which were real spaces in this case. But I thought that they failed in the way they presented the whole thing by finding it necessary to decorate the situation with a tent and with all kind of objects and so on. It was a certain helplessness how to present this deconstruction of the production for television and the internet in the context of an exhibition, but I think it was a very good and important start.
And were there any other manifestations or works that impressed you?
Yes, there was one that impressed me a lot, and I was walking along, as I had very little time, very fast through the main exhibition in Big Pavilion and through all these very beautiful pieces of art of Bellezza in the traditional sense, and I went through these objects and installations and so on, and then a few steps down and I heard some kind of Balkan music, and I came into this space. It was a dark space, and there was a big heap of bones, and there was the smell of bones with blood on them. And in this heap of bones there was Marina Abramović sitting in a white dress, which was already quite the color of the bones with blood on them and so on. And she was kind of grinding away on a bone, yeah, and grinding and grinding, and sometimes moaning, sometimes singing. And there were three big screens in that dark room, and this one behind this quite theatrical scene was showing Marina Abramović herself again in a short black dress and with a red scarf, really, dancing this Balkan song or dance, you know, in a very beautiful way. And there were two other screens on the side. One was showing an elderly man who had a pistol in his hand, and the other one, an elderly woman who was lifting her hands beside her head like, I have given up, I can't do anything anymore, or something like that, a gesture like that. At first, they looked like photographs, because in contrast to Marina Abramović dancing, they didn't move. But then you saw that their eyelids were moving, so it was obvious that it was a videotape too. And the videotapes came to an end, and one heard Marina Abramović is moaning and singing much clearer, of course. And the title appeared, Balkan Baroque. And then the tape started again, and on the tape where Marina Abramović had been dancing before, she appeared in a white coat like a doctor or scientist, and she told the story about rats that don't kill each other. Only under very extreme conditions you can get them to kill their own tribe by basically taking nourishment away from them, and then they grow very long teeth and they are able to kill their own tribe. It was obviously it related in some way to the situation in former Yugoslavia, or how Yugoslavia broke down. While she was telling this story, the elderly man was just looking into the camera. And I don't remember exactly how he had his hands. And the elderly woman, I think, had her hands in front of her eyes. And then, after the parable was over, she was in her black dress again, and she started the dance. And the man got the pistol in his hand and the woman took the hands away from her eyes. And altogether, it was a very short cycle of these video tapes. The whole situation was like a shock. I mean, one got a real shock coming from this traditional beauty into this kind of performance, and I don't think I could now make a judgment about the aesthetic criteria, or was it now in this sense or that sense a good thing or not so good or too theatrical or too baroque or whatever. But I know that I walked into a completely different category of art in a way that hit me almost physically, you know. With, so to speak, also with its stench and its presence and this endurance thing and so on. And I think it was one of the most important experiences for me in this Biennale, but I don't think it's possible to keep it up for the whole Biennale. Of course, I'm sure it was only possible to do this for the opening period. That was an incredible achievement by the artist herself. That relates back to her early performance work, this kind of endurance thing. And I must say, it was a tremendously courageous piece and a tremendously political one, of course. It was just very, very strong.
My name is Andrea Spiegel, and I'm coming from Vienna just as a visitor to the Biennale.
Andreas, you've been here a day or so, walking around. Have you seen anything that's particularly interested you in relation to the national pavilions?
I would say the most interesting thing for me is the whole structure of the Biennale. I'm every year really surprised that you have the opportunity just to walk around. So it's for me more an atmospherical thing, apart from the artworks that were quite disappointing to me, I have to say, in general. And I saw now nearly all the pavilions.
Do you think that the structure and infrastructure of the Venice Biennale is a complete anachronism? I mean, do you think it works?
I would say it doesn't work at all. I mean, this idea of this kind of national distinctions is just ridiculous nowadays. And I ask myself why there is a reason just to go on with that tradition, or if there shouldn't be another option to use the structure, these different pavilions, but just to run in a completely different sense.
So the idea of individual pavilions, which are rather like national embassies, yeah, with sort of moats around them and people swim from one to the other, it does seem strange, I have to admit.
It does, yeah. It's like cheap flight tickets. If you say, well, I walk from Uruguay to France in 2 minutes or something, so that's quite nice. It's a really poetic idea, but
on the other hand, people would say, well, yes, we know that, but at least it's an opportunity and it's an existing structure for contemporary works to be presented and seen and so on.
But that's my major question, if we really can talk about contemporary works, because most works that I saw at this biennial, I would say, are quite well-known artists, and some of them with their, I would say, old works. And it was quite disappointing for me, especially when you see, for example, this Italian pavilion, where you see all the great names from, I don't know, Klaus Oldenburg to, I don't know who else was there. It was just disappointing, completely. And so I think we have to change it to make it really contemporary.
That was the Germano Celant concept of past, present, future. I mean, do you think then it didn't really represent that notion of transition and change?
Do you really think that that's a concept, to talk about the past, the present and future? I just don't know, that's not a concept for me. That's just an excuse, a general excuse, because then you can do everything and it really looks like that.
So let me draw you on any pavilions that you have seen that have impressed you, because we talked about the Austrian pavilion, and as you're from Austria...
Yeah, I think that the idea just to present the catalogues there instead of the work, because it's a retrospective show, works with this idea of, let's say, information. And it's just not possible to reproduce this kind of authentic history or something like that. So in this way, it really works in a quite good way.
It's presenting, I suppose, research material for reevaluation, rather than choosing a series of artists for presentation.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to say that especially the Wiener Gruppe, the Viennese group, was a very, very important group of people, of young artists, who really tried to open up the different media. So even when they were literate poets or artists, they all worked together as musicians. Sometimes they wrote, sometimes they made artwork. So it was a kind of interdisciplinary discourse that was very, very important. And no one really cared about it for the last four decades. So in a way, it makes really sense for me.
Finishing then on the general issue of the Biennale, but also linking it to what's going to happen next week, which is Documenta and, of course, Munster. Is there a role for these international blockbusting shows now? I mean, do they actually contribute to the discourse in contemporary art?
I would say probably they don't contribute to the discourse, because that's developing somewhere else, in quite small places, maybe hidden places even, or just small institutions, but they have a function nevertheless, and that's for me this kind of to make things popular. And I think maybe even when we work, let's say, in a kind of real contemporary discourse, we are just normally really marginalized, and maybe these exhibitions, they have a function, but just to popularize things, nothing more.
So, now sitting on the steps of the French Pavilion with Hans Ulbricht. Hans, what do you think of the Biennale so far? What's your general analysis of it?
You see, I think that the Giardini is a very interesting concept of a large-scale exhibition. The only premise which is in this sense wrong is that, you know, it follows a national model of the 19th century. The idea that you have a large-scale exhibition where you have a certain number of pavilions, which are like in a Russian matryoshka, shows within the show, which are autonomous, and then you have a walk, you know, from one pavilion to the next pavilion as a promenadology, is a very, very interesting model of a fragmented large-scale exhibition where there is still cohesion. And in this sense, much, much more interesting than a large-scale exhibition where everything is jammed into one building. However, of course, the limits of this model is the fact that, you know, it's a bit like football, it's a national cliché. And in this sense, I think it would be fabulous if in all these pavilions, you know, would be independent shows.
I mean, the idea of this, of course, is an anachronism, because it was set up at a time when everybody was much more conscious of national identity, national pride. All those barriers seem to be eroding, or having been eroded. So, I mean, do you think that generally such a structure is tenable? I mean, should it be reassessed, do you think, with a view to changing it?
It's more interesting to think about what could be a new structure for a large-scale exhibition. I mean, it's something we tried to define with the Berlin Biennial. What could be a biennial for the 90s, which, you know, corresponds to needs and necessities of the 90s. And however, I really think that the Giardini as a model for an exhibition is a very, you know, tenable model.
Yeah. You created a model anyway in the Life Live when you looked at a whole area of British contemporary art, didn't you? And the model grew, but it wasn't necessarily limited to specific physical spaces and physical objects. There were publications, there was research, there was video and so on.
Yeah, actually, we're working on a show for the Secession in Vienna. It's called Cities on the Move, but it takes as a point of departure the Asian city, a phenomenon of the explosion of the Asian city. And the idea is of a more interdisciplinary exhibition, which starts above all with architecture, urbanism, artists, so from different point of views, reflections on this city explosion and what's the meaning, basically, of the city in the 90s. The Secession will become actually like a city. The idea is all about density. I mean, like in Hong Kong, maybe most focused the architecture of density of Hong Kong. And the idea is that in the Secession there will be 80 artists and architects in the Secession, quite a small space actually. And it's also the 100th birthday of the Vienna Secession, which started as out of the Japonisme, out of the Japanese fascination, late 19th, early 20th century of the avant-garde, basically now it's almost like an inversion at the end of this. At the end of this millennium, where finally it's almost like the energy seems in Asia.
We're sitting on the steps of the French Pavilion. What do you think of the strategy, if I can call it that, in the French Pavilion, which I believe incorporates a television broadcast and a recording studio and so on? You've actually been on it. I saw your image on one of the screens.
Yes, you see, the French Pavilion is a work of art by Fabrice Hibert, and he defined it more, you know, not as a territorial sort of space thing, but more as a time thing. So it's more like a time pavilion, so to say, with a, you know, a pre-production, a production, and then a post-production. Not only an exhibition, but that you have this pre and post thing to... So something, you know, Liam Gillick always points out, the importance of this issue. Fabrice Hibert does this here in a very straightforward way, in the sense that the pavilion started a couple of days before the opening with animated debates, roundtable discussions, film crews spreading out, making interviews. And it's also basically it's a Deleuzian en devenir. There is such a thing as a structure, but there is not such a thing as a beginning or a clear end. On the one hand, you have a room which is a studio. On the other hand, you have a maquillage room. And you have a third space, which is the cutting of the film. And then you have in the major space, you know, the whole thing is on view.
What happens? Is it a discussion or a debate or an interview?
Oh, it's very heteroclite in this sense. It's a very heterogeneous program. The main issue is basically that you have, you know, talk shows as well as interviews, as well as, you know, the prototypes of Fabrice Hibert being tested. It's possible to react. So, for example, Uri Zeig made a manifest of the Israeli pavilion and the absence of the Palestinian pavilion, the non-existing Palestinian pavilion. And the manifest of Uri Zeig became part of a Fabrice Hibert broadcast.
What other pavilions have you seen that have interested you?
I think that, you know, in terms of the of maybe this critique of the cliché of a national exhibition, the Nordic pavilion is very exciting this year with fabulous work of Mark Dyne, who took out of the canal some 9-10 square meters of mud, who takes out of the mud more and more objects, and he actually makes an archaeology. It's an archaeology of the Venice Canal, where you have fragments of the 17th, fragments of the 18th, fragments of the 19th, and fragments of the 20th century.
What about the Austria Pavilion, if I can ask you about that?
Yeah, I think Mr. Fritz could maybe tell more significant things.
Well, I followed, of course, being Austrian, followed that quite interesting development that Peter Weibel, in a way, started by considering himself more a team trainer of the national art team, as in his words. And I think, once again, he quite successfully strategized the Austrian pavilion, because I can not really talk about it as an exhibition, but as a strategy to position the Austrian contribution in a very, I think, compelling and interesting way. And of course, the artists he's presenting are among the most influential, but were never recognized as a major force in visual arts. So I think it's half a coup, a strike of genius by Peter Weibel to do it like that, to fill the pavilion with books, and of course half due to the artists that were more important than what has been recognized so far. And in the Austrian context, I think it was very important to go back to that group and present them as a major influence. Yeah, and the amazing thing about the Vienna group is that a lot of the concepts originate in the early 50s, prior to a lot of conceptual art and visual art, visual poetry.
It leads us to point d'ironie, because, you know, Peter Weibel decided to disperse the book on the Wiener Gruppe, which is certainly the thickest book ever having been given away. It's, I mean, you know, formally remembering a bit of the Gonzalez Torres passports, which was stapled, and here it's the same thing, but with an incredibly thick book. Mm-hmm. And there is this newspaper, which is distributed all over the Giardini, Point d'Ironie. It's a project I'm curating with Agnes Bay, and we invite an artist every month to do an issue. It's a kind of a hybrid between a newspaper and a poster, because it can either be pinned as a poster or it can also be folded and used as a newspaper. And this special issue for Venice was entirely layouted and designed by American artist Joseph Quigley, who is deaf since the age of 11, and works a lot about communication and exchange of information in these lapses and in between spaces, when the lip reading doesn't work, when these tiny notes are handed back and forth. So you have lots of these, you know, tiny sheets, and he arranges them in a different narration. So it's like fragments of a narration, which are at the tableau. And this 80,000 copies of these newspapers are distributed.
Distributing it or disseminating it at the Biennale is a way of that work actually getting out into the world, and you use it as a specific way of externalizing an individual artist's practice.
Yeah, it's the in-between space, out of the other pavilions, and then out of the floating the things in between, I mean, bridges.
If there could be a legitimate reason for the big events, it's that they mostly spark counter-actions or in-between actions, and that's very often the the side events that become the more influential than the main event, and this dialectics of the main event and everybody else who's in the fringe, I think adds to the value that that big exhibitions can have right now. Of course, for the people professionally involved, the creation of communication has the same value than actually what's being presented. And Venice lends itself quite ideally to it because of the Giardini structure and the somewhat, you know, leisurely setting of it.
Fabrice, we're in your installation here in the French Pavilion. Perhaps you could describe what you've done here, because it comprises a lot of elements, including a broadcast TV.
During the first days, there is a TV production here in the pavilion until the 20th of June, and after we have a diffusion, only diffusion here. In the first part of the pavilion, there is all the stuff we need to make some debates, some element of set, decor, and 14 different monitors. And the three other parts of the pavilion, there is a studio of production for recording, a studio where there is a broadcast, and the other part, it's for the makeup, montage, and everything, internet. Everything in the same room, because I think there is link between them.
What are the primary issues that you are exploring in the idea of making recorded interviews for television?
I want to explore this medium, because I didn't know this medium before, and with all this possibilities, I can show my way of thinking, but I want to show this way to find this medium, and it's why there is two moments, a moment of production and the other part, the only diffusion. I think they will have some program in a new way to think the TV.
When you walk into the pavilion, though, the physical structure that you enter is a large tent, isn't it, with video monitors around showing the productions that you've made.
The tent is for North African, because I'm very interested about the idea of this TV provisoire and the way that in this country there is a traditional way to think the nomadism. And I'm so interested about Islam conception of movie. It's a different way to think image, and I think we need that to make an opposition.
Which television station is it being broadcast on then?
We have connection with some different television, TV5 for France, France 2 for Paris, Paris Première, SDR in Germany, Rai Uno in Italy, Canal 22 in Mexico. There is another private channel in LA.
So my name is Marie-Ange Guilleminot and I'm coming from Paris, France. Here I am in the Biennale of Venice, invited to the Corderie to present a work, and I decided to take advantage of this moment to realize this special room with a transformation parlor, where I invite the public to sit for a moment and to have the possibility to be initiated. And the idea is to begin with a tight, woman tight, and to transform this tight with a very simple way to do it, just by knots, and to realize your bag.
So it's an interactive piece. People come and sit on your chairs in this red circle, mm-hmm. and actually change women's tights and make them into various shapes, yeah?
Yes. Yes, I'm interested in the fact that this moment of the Biennale, people are very, very much busy of looking many things. So for me, it's a way to give a possibility for the people to have a rest and also to see things differently. I mean, to have the possibility to practice something physically and to begin with the touching. And then it's also, for me, it's very important, this aspect that the object himself is a pretext. So it's just the processes of changing, or the processes of making something to your own life, to adapt it to yourself. And I also decide to work with tight, who are something very fragile and very, who need a special care. So you really have, the way you have to do it, you also have to be very careful, and you have to consider that you are doing something who is going to be not non-aggressive. And so the moment you finish to realize this, it's a relation between two persons, and there is this kind of intimacy that you can have in such a place, which is quite unusual.
When people make whatever they're going to make, do you give them an instruction, or do you just ask them to do whatever they want to do with the tights?
First of all, I'm not alone. There is three girls and one boy who are coming to help me. So first day, I was giving him the initiation, how to realize themselves this bag. And then after, when they finish to teach it, they began now to learn to the people. And what is also very interesting is the fact that the language have no importance. You don't have to speak, because even if you want to begin to explain by words how to realize the bag, it's quite impossible. The only way you have to do it is to realize it and to show it. So it's began a thing without language.
It's one of the few pieces here in Venice that is interactive, in that it directly engages with an audience or with the visitors to the exhibition.
This is also in relation with work with very interesting. Fabrice Hibert is in the French pavilion and creates here a TV. He invites artists to come to the TV and to realize performance and to make things and to speak on the TV and to say what they want. And I'm able now to do a film. And this morning I was in a shop. I transformed my tight in bag, and then I put the things I bought in the bag, and then I leave. So this is also something that we are connected. For me, my work have to be something that people can eat. I want the things to be, it's ephemeral in a way, but it's more the idea of you can have it.
The work is the strategy to interact with people.
It's a pretext, not a strategy. You can do it, or you are also able not to look at. It's something about our life. We can pass by without looking, but we can also stop and do something and participate and consider other and so on and so on. So
Henrik Håkansson.
Henrik, we're in the Nordic Pavilion in front of your piece, which involves growing elements, plants and so on, and traps with bugs in, and there's a sort of small garden outside. It seems to evoke ideas to do with ecology and growth and nature and so on, but there's also what looks like kind of a small laboratory where you're actually analysing or investigating the materials in this installation. Perhaps you could talk about the underlying concerns.
Yeah, no, the installation is not an investigation, there's not like traps. It's cages where I'm breeding butterflies and I'm trying to produce more butterflies. So the whole process is about breeding and rearing and attracting butterflies and moths, both from the outside and also here. I use obtained species from a butterfly farm, and I breed them here, and then I try to mate them in the cages in a sort of controlled way. They're also hatching freely in the small environment here, and they could leave whenever they want.
So our issues to do with growth and ecology, things that interest you?
Yes.
Yeah. Right, you've created a sort of a microclimate in this pavilion where the butterflies can thrive.
There's no food plants, so to say, nectar-giving plants inside. So the adult butterfly will not stay here. They will go outside where a small garden is created and hopefully in the park to establish new livestock or something. In here, it's only the plants are making the food plants for the larva of the species that I'm using in this piece.
But on the left here, we have a table with a magnifying glass and some.
Yeah, that's my work table.
Yeah, what are you actually doing on that table? Because there's also.
I'm sitting there, and that's why when I'm here, I'm going to be here through September and work every day. So here I sort of make a status of which butterfly that hatched, and also I'm here arranging and changing food plants.
So your participation in this work is fundamental, is it? I mean,
it's a very very big part of the work.
And you will stay here in Venice till September,
yes.
Working and
yes,
breeding more butterflies.
Yes, and after this 15th of September, when I leave, the peace will remain where there will be no butterflies. There will be no action. The process is over.
But the butterflies, once they've grown into adults, they will all be, they will go, they will leave, they will fly away.
They will put in this inside area and they will find the way out.
Right. And what about the little garden you've created outside? Is that a natural environment for butterflies?
No, it's not a natural environment, but it's constructed or made due to lists of recommended food nectar-giving plants of butterflies, and it's just a small, very, very small garden in a big other park that's like trying to give a sort of good flowers. And there's also fruit plants for larvae, so there is a possibility for the butterflies here to also put eggs on the plants there. Some of the plants are also existing already in the park.